let us begin. This week we begin a unit, a mini-unit, if you like, on poetry during the Cold War. Having done writing in modern war, we're now moving into the post-war period. But, as the very nomenclature indicates, Cold War means that war had not gone away. So what we want to do in these weeks is to focus on this question of, again, perennial question for us, how literature engages with the modern world within the context of Cold War, war that continues, as it were, by other means than necessarily overt and antagonistic open conflict. With this lecture, I want to talk about Elizabeth Bishop as a Cold War poet, and basically three goals here, just to outline it for you. I want to introduce poetry from the mid-20th century so that you can now contrast it with poetry from the earlier part of the century, the poetry of, for example, Eliot and Williams that we looked at, early modernist work, and to see what has happened to our terms in the intervening period. What is going on with modernism, for example? We want to then open up the question of how we might read poetry in this particular context, the Cold War context, the context of U.S. hegemony in a bipolar world, you know, dominated by two great superpowers, two great systems of viewing the world. What's changed about poetry in this context? How does it, as a medium, and we need to focus on it as a medium, respond to the presence of newer media, competing media, if you like, the rise of mass media, radio, film, television, and so on, new forms of global connection and constitution and institution? You know, it's a signal that in 1945, the United Nations begins business in downtown or midtown Manhattan. The central world capital of global dispensations after World War II. What happens to poetry in that context? And then we want to lay the basis for future study, not just of Bishop and the figures that we'll be looking at in the next couple of weeks, but also more recent and even contemporary writers. And I want to do that for a personal agenda reason, because I teach, you know, contemporary work, especially American work, and I'd like to see you in modules in the years to come. So there's something of a fishing operation here. All right, so we have Bishop as an American poet in the 1950s. And the first thing to ask is, well, why are we focusing on her, and why her as an American poet in the 1950s? In this module, we tend not to approach literature as expressive of an exclusively or restrictively nationalist expression. Yeah? We've been quite cosmopolitan so far this year. Instead, we approach literature comparatively. We look at it as part of a world phenomenon of writing. So, again, this question, why Bishop, and why Bishop as an American writer? Well, the glib answer, probably the easy answer, is to say 1950 in the United States, this is the dominant moment for the country on the world stage. Probably it never was as powerful ever again after that particular moment. The immediate 10, 15 years after the end of World War II. Right? So we would read its cultural production then, something along the lines of why we read increasingly writing and cultural production from China and India now, as a kind of world map or a guide to the salient features of the global conjuncture. You want to understand the world in the mid-20th century, look to the United States, because the United States is to a greater or lesser extent, setting the agenda. So, you know, we would want to understand what's happening in the ancient world, for example, circa 5 BC, by looking at Rome. And so, for the same reason, we look at the United States during this period. But there's a less glib answer, I think, to why we're looking particularly at, say, Bishop. And I would want to put her into the picture with another poet who seems radically unlike her, Allen Ginsberg, who we might look at in more detail next week with the 1960s. Why? Why these two figures? Well, there's an interesting model for understanding the reading of literatures that comes from a comparativist named Franco Moretti. He indicates two models for looking at the way that literature develops in national contexts. One model, and they're both borrowed from the world of science, natural history. One model is the tree. Yeah? So you have a central trunk representing the national tradition, and that is expressive of what is most distinctive and exceptional about that particular national tradition. It throws off branches on either side, which grow into twigs and get variously attenuated in its relation to the main trunk. But nonetheless, that trunk is what provides the literature with its identity. And indeed, this is one way of modeling, you know, the growth of a national literature like English literature. Yeah. Another model that Moretti indicates is the wave. Don't worry. The wave, by contrast, emphasizes transnational flows across borders of nation and language. And in so doing, it gives rise to a continually fluid and continually transformative process of appropriation, translation, domination, modification, and importation. This is a process of travel, of discovery, and also of conquest. That relationship, the wave relationship among literatures, is one that I think we want to pay special attention to during this period, during the Cold War period, dominated as it is by the United States in the so-called free world. So, why study these poets? Why study Bishop and also Ginsberg? What do they have to teach us about poetry and its relation to modernity? Well, both of them, Bishop, I think you can see, especially in her travel poems, give us a figure of the poet engaging with the problem of global consciousness as it manifests itself in writing. And global consciousness, this is the thesis of the lecture, if you like, it's a problem for writing, for poetry especially. Because we're not just dealing with what can be said in a straightforward way about being in the modern world, but with what poetry is especially good at. What is poetry especially good at? Naming particulars that resist translation. So, you can see the problem, yeah? If poetry is what resists paraphrase, you know, that which could not be said in any other way, that's poetry. That is one sort of high modernist or formalist definition of what poetry does, its mission. And global consciousness, on the other hand, depends on forms of translation, how what happens over there gets transmitted over here, and vice versa. How can poetry register the world's details, except as a kind of parochialism? Well, this is what's happening in my corner, on the one hand. Or, on the other, a kind of neo-imperial flattening out, such as we get with so-called globalized culture, you know, the McDonaldization of the world, or the Hollywoodization of the world. This is the problem that poetry faces in registering global consciousness, and this is a problem that Elizabeth Bishop faces as an American traveling, being a tourist, you know, as she is. Sometimes she's a tourist in her own backyard, as it were, and sometimes she's a tourist in exotic and foreign places like Brazil. Just a little bit of critical theory to sort of bookmark as we're looking at Bishop and thinking about this problem, global consciousness. The German critic, Theodor Adorno, famously forbidding and difficult and resistant to all forms of mass and popular culture. He has a phrase for looking at how poetry does its work, culturally speaking, socially speaking. He says, the unsolved contradictions, you might write this down because it's kind of important, the unsolved contradictions of reality return in artworks as imminent problems of form. Say it again. The unsolved contradictions of reality return in artworks as imminent problems of form. Imminent meaning inherent or intrinsic. How does this provide a guide for us? Well, it means that we have to look not just to the poem as an integral and organic whole, which is the way that much mid-20th century poetry guides asked us to look at it, but also as a record of omission, of cuts, silences, irregularities, strange details and anomalies, deformations, if you like, as much as formations in poems. And we need to pay attention to these things in order to read what they have to tell us. Adorno is saying, yes, poetry is not the same as reality. Writing, literature is not the same as reality. It isn't a direct reflection, a one-way or one-to-one correspondence. The way that we can get a purchase on the reality in poems is by looking at what happens at the level of form, not just or even at the level of content. Okay. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. But the proof is in the pudding. So let's look at the first poem in the collection of Elizabeth Bishop that we've asked you to acquire, the complete poems. This is called The Map. And it is a good starting place for looking at what Bishop does. Because it seems so simple on the surface. So let's begin naively as naive readers. And that's how several of Bishop's own poems begin. By looking at the epigraph to by looking at this poem, and then I'll begin also with the epigraph to her last book, which is Geography 3. It's basically an excerpt from a 19th century geography textbook, and here's how it goes. What is a map? A picture of the whole, or a part of the Earth's surface. What are the directions on a map? Toward the top, north. Toward the bottom, south. To the right, east. To the left, west. In what direction from the center of the picture is the island? North. In what direction is the volcano? The cape, the bay, the lake, the strait, the mountains, the isthmus? What is in the east, in the west, in the south, in the north, in the northwest, in the southeast, in the northeast, in the southwest? Just the excerpt from the geography textbook. They're naive questions that lead to a kind of dizzying acceleration or an existential rush, if you like, of questioning that amounts to something like panic. That is the signal, the keynote of Bishop's work. She's always engaged with questions of direction, of location, of identity, especially animal and human identity, world geography, geopolitics. These are Bishop's themes, but she doesn't deal with them in the abstract or as a series of generalizations. It's all in the particulars. And these facts, the facts that are indicated in that series of questions from the textbook, lead to a kind of global panic, the structure of feeling behind her work, which we see, for example, in the title of a critical collection on Bishop's work called Poetry and the Sense of Panic. It's an apt title because For so long, people said, oh, that Elizabeth Bishop, love her. What's great about her is that she's so calm and tranquil, and you know, her descriptions are so natural and free-flowing, and it's all very, very restful, almost like the mood music to the mid-20th century bourgeois existence. Nothing could be further from the truth. Her poetry is riven with fear and anxiety. Watch for it, because that's where its secrets lie. Another sense of panic within the global stage at this moment in history. There's a book by Graham Greene, The Quiet American. Anybody see the movie? No. Starring Michael Caine and that guy from The Mummy Returns. Oh. It's very good. The novel by Graham Greene concerns very presciently the situation in Vietnam. Not in the 1960s when U.S. involvement had escalated into bloody conflict, but in the early 1950s when France was still fighting a rearguard colonial war against its former colony. And Green, who, as you might know, had quite some investment in the question of spying and Cold War and global war patterns of intrigue, writes this novel in which an American is ostensibly on duty in Saigon as a kind of an advisor, that he has a British journalist friend who narrates the novel, and they have conversations about the situation in Vietnam. What's going to happen? French are losing. Looks like the Vietnamese under Ho Chi Minh will win. What does this mean? Et cetera, et cetera. And the American at one point says, if Indochina goes, that is to say, if Vietnam goes, I know the record, says the British world-weary journalist. I know the record. Siam goes, that's Thailand. Malaya goes. Indonesia goes. What does go mean? What does go mean? That's the question. How do we get into that dizzying vertigo or acceleration of panic that leads from the sense of global interconnectedness and global intrigue related to the Cold War. Go, of course, in that context of Green's novel, means falls, seeds to the communists, the Reds, like the domino theory that was so popular at the time. If one thing falls in Southeast Asia, so went the reasoning, they'll all fall. They'll all fall under Soviet influence, and the Cold War will be lost. Now, I wanted to begin by suggesting that Elizabeth Bishop represents something like the quiet American of mid-20th century poetry. Not that she is invested in the micro-struggles or even the macro-struggles of the Cold War. She isn't. She is almost determinedly apolitical. You will look very hard in her work to find any overt mention of the politics of the day. So it's not a simple analog to Green's protagonist, but she is a quiet American in relation to her time, especially the Cold War period, which we're studying now. As a kind of canary, if you like, in the mineshaft of poetry's relationship to these matters, these large global matters. She focuses on very small things often, tiny details. But how do those details relate to this larger framework? That's our question. Her reputation, as I've said, tends to discourage this line of inquiry. Instead, she's known for the following qualities, which I'm sure you have noticed as you just sort of idly looked through the poems in the book. She's very good at description. She's killer at description, really, especially of places and animals. If you've ever been to Nova Scotia or to Florida, you will recognize those places in the way that Bishop writes about them. She was unmatched at combining a kind of colloquial ease in writing poetry, an ease of voice that has a grace to it, certainly a grace in the rhythm and the phrasing. So sometimes it seems so prosaic as to be almost not poetry at all. And then you notice, as for example in the opening poem to Questions of Travel, her third book, that it's actually written in rhyming quatrains. Try sort of reciting out loud to yourself. It's very difficult to notice that there is, in fact, a rhyme scheme there at all. It's very subtle, the way that she does it. You also may notice that she has a kind of skewed, surreal take on ordinary objects and scenarios. And this comes from her early interest in surrealism, especially surrealist ways of looking, of vision, which allows her to express a kind of quirky angle or perspective on the strangeness of everyday objects and events. And finally, the obvious thing, she doesn't write much about herself. This is the great age of Freud in America. Sometimes it seems that half of the educated population was on the couch, you know, trying to follow the labyrinth of their psyche back to what they felt about mom and dad, and, you know, trying to work through that, get over it, you know, not let it dominate the psychic life of these hardworking mid-20th century Americans. Elizabeth Bishop, not so much. You don't see any confessional impulse in her work. She's not out there to tell you what it's like for her and how this made her feel and the trauma and the bloodshed. It's, you know, her fellow poets, Robert Lowell, John Berryman, that's more their game. And certainly when we get to Sylvia Plath, enough said, confession becomes a whole new game. Bishop is very reticent. She's modest and discreet and quite shy about divulging personal detail. However, because she is, I'd argue, that's why you have to look for the personal in Bishop. That's why you have to look for what's standing behind this relatively impersonal, objective stance that the poet maintains with respect to her subject matter. There is, in fact, a kind of publicity in her privateness that we want to investigate. And perhaps that publicity has to do with these very public questions of the global conjuncture during the Cold War. Okay. So my sort of take here is that from the perspective of the early 21st century, we need to read Bishop differently from the way that she was canonized in the mid to late 20th century. She was held up as an example of a pure poet, a poet's poet, who just focused exactly on what poetry should be focusing on, which is minute and significant particulars. What if we read her differently, however? What if we look in her work for examples of the way in which that does not actually hold? Well, the age that we're speaking of, the 1950s, or really the long 1950s, say 1945, the end of the war, the establishment of the UN, the beginning of the Cold War, all the way through 1960, or even 1963, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, these constitute something like the long decade of American post-war prosperity. It was also the age of American anxiety. W. H. Auden coined this phrase, the age of anxiety, to describe what he took to be the dominant tone or feeling of this decade. Why? Well, it was characterized by paranoia. Nuclear trauma, certainly, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the perpetual threat of its follow-up, and with it a repressive domestic conformism on a massive scale. Elizabeth Bishop, during this period, was writing some of modern America's most anxious poems. We want to investigate the source of this anxiety and determine not only how it shapes her work, but how her work makes available new ways of expressing anxiety, new moods within that general field of anxiety. In so doing, what we're arguing against is the kind of restrictive formalism that saw her just as the poet's poet, the pure poet, the poet that could be held up as an example of how American culture during the mid-20th century was able to transcend the political and the messily personal. Now, the kind of mode or approach that I've been describing, that kind of transcending, formalist, it's all good, focus on the poem as an organic whole, this is what we refer to as the new criticism in the United States and also to some extent here. Here, it's a little bit different. But the new criticism was essentially a bi-national production between the US and the UK. Certain Cambridge dons from the early 20s began to focus in a new formalistic way on poetry as a separate or autonomous discourse. That lesson got exported over the Atlantic. This is an example of the kind of transnational flows I'm talking about. Was then repackaged as a kind of basic American pragmatic take on poetry as a formal discourse, and then sold to millions of college students in textbooks. The banner publication for this movement was Understanding Poetry. It's worth looking it up. It's online. Especially the 1950 edition. It was first published in 1938, then revised for 1950. And what's interesting about that 1950 second edition is the way that it revises a little bit some of its earlier militancy on not reading poetry as a guide to so-called real life. The new critical approach says, we read poetry for what it says about poetry. It is a self-referential discourse. And if it makes appeals to the larger human existence, it is only in strictly universal terms. Love, death, the transcendent, so forth. However, in the 1950 edition, we get the following interesting sentence. What we can learn about the origin of a poem may, if we do not confuse origin and poem, enlarge our understanding and deepen our appreciation. So you see, there's already a bit of an acknowledgement there from the editors, Brooks and Warren, that poetry may actually have something to do with the way that it's made, that we can look at it not simply as a verbal object, an output or outcome of a process, but we can look at it as a process itself. What if poetry is the process of making it rather than just the finished product? Okay, well, that's in mind. Let's go back to that first poem, The Map. I wish I had a recording of Bishop reading this, but she was famously shy, not so surprising, and did not record her work much. And those recordings that she did make were generally of poems that I don't really need to focus on, though I will have one excerpt from her late poem, which I think is certainly worth looking at in detail, Crusoe in England. But you should imagine, as you listen to the lines of the poem, a fairly flat, Midwest-sounding American voice who is not giving much inflection to these lines, is letting the lines more or less speak for themselves. Land lies in water. It is shadowed green. Shadows, or are they shallows, at its edges, showing the line of long sea-weeded ledges where weeds hang to the simple blue from green. Or does the land lean down to lift the sea from under, drawing it unperturbed around itself? All along the fine tan sandy shelf, is the land tugging at the sea from under? Well, what we immediately notice is this almost textbook style of pointed observation, focusing on the particulars of the map, drawing our attention to its contrasts, but at the same time insinuating, again, that note of unease. Does the land lean down to lift the sea from under, drawing it unperturbed around itself? Or is the land tugging at the sea from under? There's a sense of difficulty at deciding, at determining what constitutes the dividing line between land and sea. Shadows, on the one hand, shallows. Are they shallows or shadows? The very echo of the word is kind of a poet's way of sliding from one register of meaning to another is in the near echo in sound, suggests that we have a kind of ambiguity in reading the map, which ought to be more or less a cut and dried process, a process of determining where we are, locating our, you know, constituting a kind of GPS system for the observer. And instead, what we have is a note of displacement or decentering. And this is a note that continues to get developed through the poem. We look at the names of seashore towns running out to sea. We see the peninsulas take the water between thumb and finger, like women feeling for the smoothness of yard goods. And then the final question, are they assigned, or can the countries pick their colors? Wonderful, naive question, isn't it? You know, you look at a map, which is entirely arbitrary in the way that it allocates color to different nations. You know, it may be that you know, Britain is pink in one map and blue in another. It just depends on the color key of that particular map. But the notion that countries might be able to pick their own colors instantly brings up this entire register of consideration involving national self-determination. Can countries decide how they get to look in a global mapping? And how do we know what's north, what's east, what's south, what's west? Well, it all depends on where you are. Right? And this, the sense of displacement, of relativism in perspective, depending on relativism in space, emphasizes the way that the map is not innocent. It is not a neutral form of transmitting knowledge. It, in fact, carries a whole raft load of presumptions and even ideological freights in the way that it carves up the geography of the world. And this is something that the poem ever so delicately asks us to acknowledge. Geography here takes precedence over history, space over time. But we shouldn't regard that predominance as the index of a kind of neutral knowledge. It is anything but neutral. And surely in the context of the 1950s, a decade in which the struggle over two halves of a peninsula like Korea was enough to threaten a world war, these things become extremely important. Okay, from that poem, you might sort of go in any number of ways through the book and look at similar poems. For example, the introductory poem to Questions of Travel, which I mentioned earlier, Arrival at Santos, suggests a new way of encountering foreign or exotic location. The biographical background to this for Bishop is that she herself traveled to Brazil mainly to get away from the United States. And we don't necessarily have all of the reasons available for why she made that decision, but there is one particular consideration that might be noted. That is, Bishop was made the first, one of the early poet laureates of the Library of Congress. This was something like an analogous position to the poet laureate here. Essentially, it was a public function for a poet designed to promote or spread the notion of poetry to the masses. When a bishop was made poet of the Library of Congress in 1950, that same year, a witch hunt began in the United States Congress, not just against communists, about which you presumably know something, the so-called McCarthy Red Scare, but also against homosexuals. And written into the congressional record was the directive from one of the congressmen in U.S. government to find those undeclared homosexuals and have them outed because they represented a threat to domestic security. It's extraordinary language if you look at it from the perspective of today, because it is so nakedly prejudiced. But it is also an index of the way that the different forms of paranoia operating in America this time were connected. It wasn't simply a drive against communists within the context of the Cold War, but the way in which that drive was used to mobilize a kind of internal or domestic repression against all forms of dissidence. And those included not just political radicals and leftists, but also social and cultural radicals, dissidents of all kinds, and, one might argue, women who preferred not to conform to the model of the conventional 1950s housewife. All of this is part of the background to, for example, a novel like Sylvia Plath's The Bell Jar, which expresses something of the paranoia of being female in this decade from that perspective. Bishop was herself lesbian, but never made mention of it, certainly not directly in her writing. But something of the paranoia that came with that witch hunt in the U.S. Congress at a time when she held a public position is perhaps behind her decision ultimately to leave the United States and to go somewhere else. To go to Brazil is a fairly radical move. Within that that shift from the United States, from Washington to Brazil, we can trace a certain line of flight that does actually constitute a main motif or line in Bishop's poetry, not just in the poems that deal directly with Brazil as a question of, you know, discovery and travel, as in this book, but also of the encounter with the other. The encounter with the other is something that Bishop is continually engaging with, whether it's the other as human or the other as hybrid human. There's that great poem, The Man Moth, from her first book, which is based entirely on a misprint that she saw in a newspaper, which was meant to refer to the mammoth, and instead it was The Man Moth. Out of that, she made an entire poem creating a kind of quasi-human being who haunts the subways of New York at night and climbs up the sides of skyscrapers. Great, surreal sort of imaginative transformation. And crucially makes reference to the presence of the third rail, the so-called live or electric rail that conducts the subways under Manhattan. The third rail is also a code word for being gay during the 1950s. And this is something that Bishop, whether she intended it or not, certainly includes at various points in her poetry. So she goes down to Brazil, eventually takes up a lover there, Lota de Macedo Soares, very interesting woman in her own right, and writes a series of poems, travel poems, about the Brazilian landscape and about the Brazilian fauna and flora and its people. Sometimes she takes the voices of native Brazilians. Sometimes she acts the part of an observer or an outsider. Let's look at that Arrival at Santos poem now in similar detail to see if something of the same naive questioning that we get in The Map carries over. In the beginning, it seems very much like The Map. Here is a coast, here is a harbor. Here, after a meager diet of horizon, is some scenery, impractically shaped and, who knows, self-pitying mountains, sad and harsh beneath their frivolous greenery, with a little church on top of one. And warehouses, some of them painted a feeble pink or blue, and some tall, uncertain palms. Oh, tourist, is this how this country is going to answer you and your immodest demands for a different world and a better life and complete comprehension of both at last and immediately after 18 days of suspension? Of course, playing making fun of the very stance that she's adopting in that opening set of stanzas. O tourist, yes, this is how the tourist encounters a new land, is to notice in a kind of fanciful way that the mountains look almost self-pitying. To notice, for example, in another poem that the waterfalls look like tear stains as they fall down the side of rock. And gradually she anthropomorphizes, historicizes, and humanizes this landscape from the very particular perspective of a Norte Americano traveler engaging with the South. Wherever you see Bishop working with another country in this way, but also with other beings like armadillos, other other animals, other species, try to focus on the way that she is negotiating this encounter with the other so as to call into question the position of the speaker. This is crucial. It's the speaker who gives us the parameters with which we are to encounter this subject matter, but the speaker is, in some cases, an unreliable speaker, or a speaker who is limited in ways that the poem itself will help us to notice. The very language of questioning is an important thing to pay attention to in these poems, because the way that questions are asked leads back to a kind of reflection on the speaker, on the kinds of mindset or motivation that leads to those questions. And that set of questions that we would bring to these poems, I think, can be extended pretty much throughout the volume. Wherever you find a moment of wonderful description of another entity, of another place, another scenario, look to what is being filled in negatively. Remember the Adorno, the unsolved contradictions of reality. Return in artworks as imminent problems of form. Maybe the form has a struggle, as in the rhyming stanzas of Arrival at Santos, has a struggle with preserving itself in the face of this new subject matter. How does that dynamic work? That's what I think we should focus on in the seminars. Okay, in the time that I have just briefly left, I want to play this track from Crusoe in England. You all know the story of Robinson Crusoe, of course. How many have actually read the book? Okay, a handful, some. Well worth reading, though, for reasons other than the kind of boy's own adventure genre that it is often positioned in. Robinson Crusoe is, in some ways, the inauguration of the tradition of the novel in England. And it is also the inauguration of the imperial tradition of the novel in England, because Robinson Crusoe sets himself up as a kind of little mini-imperialist on his island, especially in his relationship with Man Friday. We get a prescient imaging of the colonial relation. This is something that Bishop surely knows all about, but she writes a poem that is very different from what you might expect with that knowledge in mind. So let's listen to what she has to read. This is an excerpt.
Crusoe in England. The island smelled of goat and guano. The goats were white, so were the gull. And both too tame, or else they thought I was a goat too, or a gull. Ba, 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 and shriek, shriek, shriek. Ba, shriek, ba. I still can't shake them from my ears, they're hurting now. The questioning shrieks, the quivocal replies, over a ground of hissing rain and hissing ambulating turtles got on my nerves. When all the gulls flew up at once, they sounded like a big tree in a strong wind. Its leaves. I'd shut my eyes and think about a tree, an oak, say, with real shade somewhere. I heard cattle getting island sick, I thought the goats were. One billy goat would stand on a volcano I christened Mont Espoir, or Mount Despair. I'd time enough to play with names, and bleep and bleep and sniff the air. I grabbed his beard and looked at him. His pupils, perpendicular, narrowed up and expressed nothing, or a little mallet. I got so tired of the very color. One day I dyed a baby goat bright red with my red berries just to see something a little different. And then his mother wouldn't recognize him. Dreams were the worst. Of course I dreamed of food and love, but they were pleasant rather than otherwise. But then I dream of things like slitting a baby's throat, mistaking it for a baby goat.
Okay. That's the giveaway, right? I dreamed of slitting a baby's throat, mistaking it for a baby goat. Again, you remember Shallows and Shadows? The echo of those two words gives rise to an entire kind of spinning out of a line of possible meaning. And the same thing happens there. But it's a moment of violence that just sits in that poem, like everything that the poem has otherwise repressed, except in its descriptions of this very desolate landscape of headless volcanoes and hissing lizards and so forth. All of that is, all the violence of the imperial relation is in the landscape in the poem. The poet's tone, the speaker, Crusoe, in England, looking back retrospectively on his time on the island, it's all delivered with a very even deliberateness. But it's that moment of violence that you need to pay attention to, because it leads us to think, well, what needed to be repressed in order for this mastery or achievement of evenness in tone to take place? This is a part of Elizabeth Bishop's containment policy, if you like. And I use that word advisedly, because containment was exactly the policy that was being used to prevent all those proto-communist dominoes from falling in the mid-20th century. Containment was the name of U.S. foreign policy leading up to Vietnam. So I think what we can say is that, yes, Elizabeth Bishop is a poet who rejects the grand, overt, and generalized themes of Cold War, of geopolitics in the late, mid to late 20th century. But she rechannels it very powerfully in the kinds of choices that she makes at the level of form in her poems, which actually end up divulging a whole lot more than many more messily confessional poems end up doing. Okay, thanks.